And then he'd been sent to Ankh, and there, in the bare, severe rooms, he'd found that there were books other than the great, heavy, brass-bound Monster Fun book. There was a whole circular world out there, full of weird places and people doing interesting things, like singing. He could hear singing. He raised his head cautiously and jumped at the tinkle of the bells on his cap. He gripped the hated things hurriedly. The singing went on. The fool peeped cautiously through the drift of meadowsweet that was providing him with perfect concealment. The singing wasn't particularly good. The only word the singer appeared to know was la, but she was making it work hard. The general tune gave the impression that the singer believed that people were supposed to sing la 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 in certain circumstances and was determined to do what the world expected of her. The fool risked raising his head a little further, and saw McGrath for the first time. She had stopped dancing rather self-consciously through the narrow meadow and was trying to plait some daisies in her hair without much success. The fool held his breath. On long nights on the hard flagstones, he had dreamed of women like her. Although, if he really thought about it, not much like her. They were better endowed around the chest. Their noses weren't so red and pointed, and their hair tended to flow more. But the fool's libido was bright enough to tell the difference between the impossible and the conceivably attainable, and hurriedly cut in some filter circuits. McGrath was picking flowers and talking to them. The fool strained to hear.
"Here's woolly filbert," she said, "and treacle worm seed, which is for inflammation of the ears."
Even Nanny Ogg, who took a fairly cheerful view of the world, would have been hard put to say anything complimentary about McGrath's voice, but it fell on the fool's ears like blossom.
"And five-leaved false mandrake, sovereign against fluxes of the bladder. Ah, and here's old man's frogbit. That's for constipation."
The fool stood up sheepishly, in a carrion of jingles. To McGrath, it was as if the meadow, hitherto supporting nothing more hazardous than clouds of pale blue butterflies and a few self-employed bumblebees, had sprouted a large red and yellow demon. It was opening and shutting its mouth. It had three menacing horns. An urgent voice at the back of her mind said, "You should run away now, like a timid gazelle. This is the accepted action in these circumstances." Common sense intervened. In her most optimistic moments, McGrath would not have compared herself to a gazelle, timid or otherwise. Besides, it added, the basic snag about running away like a timid gazelle was that in all probability she would easily outdistance him.
Said the apparition.
Uncommon sense, which, despite Granny Weatherwax's general belief that McGrath was several sticks short of a bundle, she still had insufficiency, pointed out that few demons tinkle pathetically and appeared to be quite so breathless.
"Hello,"
she said. The fool's mind was also working hard. He was beginning to panic. McGrath shunned the traditional pointed hat, as worn by the older witches, but she still held on to one of the most fundamental rules of witchcraft. It's not much use being a witch unless you look like one. In her case, this meant lots of silver jewellery with octograms, bats, spiders, dragons, and other symbols of everyday mysticism. McGrath would have painted her fingernails black, except that she didn't think she would be able to face Granny's withering scorn. It was dawning on the fool that he had surprised a witch.
"Oops,"
he said, and turned to run for it.
"Don't!"
McGrath began. But the fool was already pounding down the forest path that led back to the castle. McGrath stood and stared at the wilting posy in her hands. She ran her fingers through her hair, and a shower of wilted petals fell out. She felt that an important moment had been allowed to slip out of her grasp as fast as a greased pig in a narrow passageway. She felt an overpowering urge to curse. She knew a great many curses. Goody Wemper had been really imaginative in that department. Even the creatures of the forest used to go past her cottage at a dead run. She couldn't find a single one that fully expressed her feelings.
"Oh, bugger!"
she said.
It was a full moon again that night, and most unusually, all three witches arrived at the Standing Stone early. It was so embarrassed by this, it went and hid in some gorse bushes.
"Grebo hasn't been home for 2 days," said Nanny Ogg, as soon as she arrived. "It's not like him. I can't find him anywhere."
"Cats can look after themselves," said Granny Weatherwax. "Countries can't. I have intelligence to report, like the fire, Magrat."
"Hmm?"
"I said, light the fire, Magrat."
"Hmm?
Oh, yes." The two old women watched her drift vaguely across the moorland, tugging absently at dried-up wind clumps. Magrat seemed to have her mind on something.
"Doesn't seem to be her normal self," said Nanny Ogg.
"Yes, could be an improvement," said Granny shortly, and sat down on a rock. "She should have got it lit before we arrived. It's her job."
"She means well," said Nanny Ogg, studying Magrat's back reflectively.
"I used to mean well when I was a girl, but that didn't stop the sharp end of Goody Filter's tongue. Youngest witch serves her time. You know how it is. We had it tougher, too. Look at her. Doesn't even wear a pointy hat. How's anyone going to know?"
"You've got something on your mind, Esme," said Nanny.
Granny nodded gloomily.
"Had a visit yesterday," she said.
"Me too."
Despite her worries, Granny was slightly annoyed at this.
"Who from?" she said.
"The mayor of Loncre and a bunch of burghers. They're not happy about the king. They want a king they can trust."
"I wouldn't trust any king a burgher could trust," said Granny.
"Yes, but it's not good for anyone, all this taxing and killing folk. That new sergeant they've got is a keen man when it comes to setting fire to cottages, too. Old Ferenc used to do it too, mind, but, well..."
I know. It was more personal," said Granny. "You felt he meant it. People like to feel they're valued."
"This Felmet hates the kingdom," Nanny went on. "They all say it. They say when they go to talk to him, he just stares at them and giggles and rubs his hand and twitches a bit."
Granny scratched her chin.
"The old king used to shout at them and kick them out of the castle, mind. He used to say he didn't have no time for shopkeepers and such," she added, with a note of personal approval.
"But he was always very gracious about it," said Nanny Ogg. "And he..."
"The kingdom is worried," said Granny.
"Yes, I already said."
"I didn't mean the people. I meant the kingdom."
Granny explained. Nanny interrupted a few times with brief questions. It didn't occur to her to doubt anything she heard. Granny Weatherwax never made things up. At the end of it, she said,
"Well, my feelings exactly." "Fancy that."
"Quite so."
"And what did the animals do then?"
"Went away. It had brought them here. It let them go."
"No one ate anyone else?"
"Not where I saw."
"Funny thing."
"Right enough."
Nanny Ogg stared at the setting sun.
"I don't reckon a lot of kingdoms do that sort of thing," she said. "You saw the theatre. Kings and such are killing one another the whole time. Their kingdoms just make the best of it. How come this one takes offence all of a sudden?"
"It's been here a long time," said Granny.
"So's everywhere," said Nanny,
and added, with the air of a lifetime student,
"Everywhere's been where it is ever since it was first put there. It's called geography."
"That's just about land," said Granny. "It's not the same as a kingdom. A kingdom is made up of all sorts of things. Ideas, loyalties, memories. It all sort of exists together, and then all these things create some kind of life. Not a body kind of life, more like a living idea, made up of everything that's alive and what they're thinking, and what the people before them thought.
McGrath reappeared and began to lay the fire with an air of one in a trance.
"I can see you've been thinking about this a lot," said Nanny, speaking very slowly and carefully. "And this kingdom wants a better king. Is that it?"
"No. That is... yes, look." She leaned forward. "It doesn't have the same kind of likes and dislikes as people, right?"
Nanny Ogg leaned back.
"Well, it wouldn't, would it?" she ventured. "It doesn't care if people are good or bad. I don't think it could even tell, any more than you could tell if an ant was a good ant. But it expects the king to care for it."
"Yes, but," said Nanny wretchedly.
She was becoming a bit afraid of the gleam in Granny's eye.
"Lots of people have killed each other to become king of Loncra. They've done all kinds of murder."
"Don't matter! Don't matter!" said Granny, waving her arms.
She started counting on her fingers.
"For why?"
she said.
"One, kings go around killing each other because it's all part of destiny and such, and doesn't count as murder. And two, they killed for the kingdom. That's the important bit. But this new man just wants the power. He hates the kingdom."
"It's a bit like a dog, really," said McGrath. Granny looked at her with her mouth open to frame some suitable retort, and then her face softened.
"Very much like," she said. "A dog doesn't care if its master's good or bad, just so long as it likes the dog."
"Well, then," said Nanny,
"no one and nothing likes Felmet. What are we going to do about it?"
"Nothing. You know we can't meddle."
"You saved that baby," said Nanny.
"That's not meddling."
"Have it your way," said Nanny. "But maybe one day he'll come back. Destiny again. And you said we should hide the crown. It'll all come back, mark my words. Hurry up with that tea, McGrath."
"What are you going to do about the burgers?" said Granny.
"I told them they'll have to sort it out themselves. Once we use magic," I said, "it'd never stop. You know that."
"Right," said Granny,
but there was a hint of wistfulness in her voice.
"I tell you this, though," said Nanny. "They didn't like it much. They was muttering when they left."
McGrath blurted out, "You know the fool who lives up at the castle?"
"Little man with runny eyes," said Nanny,
relieved that the conversation had turned to more normal matters.
"Not that little," said McGrath.
"What's his name? Do you happen to know?"
"Just called Fool," said Granny. "No job for a man, that, running around with bells on."
"His mother was a beldam from over Blacklass way," said Nanny Ogg,
whose knowledge of the genealogy of Loncra was legendary.
"Bit of a beauty when she was younger. Broke many a heart, she did. Bit of a scandal there, I did hear. Granny's right, though. At the end of the day, a fool's a fool."
"Why do you want to know, McGrath?"
said Granny Weatherwax.
"Oh, one of the girls in the village was asking me," said McGrath, crimson to the ears.
Nanny cleared her throat and grinned at Granny Weatherwax, who sniffed aloofly.
"It's a steady job," said Nanny. "I'll grant you that."
"Huh," said Granny. "A man who tinkles all day. No kind of a husband for anyone, I'd say." "You..."
"She'd always know where he was," said Nanny,
who was enjoying this.
"You just have to listen."
"Never trust a man with horns on his hat," said Granny flatly.
McGrath stood up and pulled herself together, giving the impression that some bits had to come quite a long way.
"You're a pair of silly old women," she said quietly, "and I'm going home." She marched off down the path to her village without another word. The old witches stared at one another.
"Well," said Nanny.
"It's all these books they read today," said Granny. "It overheats the brain. You haven't been putting ideas in her head, have you?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean."
Nanny stood up.
"I certainly don't see why a girl should have to be single her whole life just because you think it's the right thing," she said. "Anyway, if people didn't have children, where would we be?"
"None of your girls is a witch," said Granny, also standing up.
"They could have been," said Nanny defensively.
"Yes, if you'd let them work it out for themselves, instead of encouraging them to throw themselves at men.
They're good-looking. You can't stand in the way of human nature. You'd know that if you'd ever..."
"If I'd ever what?"
said Granny Weatherwax quietly. They stared at one another in shocked silence. They could both feel it, the tension creeping into their bodies from the ground itself, the hot, aching feeling that they'd started something they must finish no matter what.
"I knew you when you were a girl," said Nanny sullenly. "Stuck up, you were."
"At least I spent most of the time upright," said Granny. "Disgusting, that was. Everyone thought so."
"How would you know?" snapped Nanny.
"You were the talk of the whole village," said Granny.
"And you were, too. They called you the Ice Maiden. Never knew that, did you?"
sneered Nanny.
"I wouldn't sully my lips by saying what they called you," shouted Granny.
"Oh, yes," shrieked Nanny. "Well, let me tell you, my good woman."
"Don't you dare talk to me in that tone of voice. I'm not anyone's good woman."
"Right."
There was another silence while they stared at one another, nose to nose, but this silence was a whole quantum level of animosity higher than the last one. You could have roasted a turkey in the heat of this silence. There was no more shouting. Things had got too bad for shouting. Now the voices came in low and full of menace.
"I should have known better than to listen to McGrath,"
growled Nanny.
"This coven business is ridiculous. It attracts entirely the wrong sort of people."
"I'm very glad we had this little talk,"
hissed Nanny Ogg.
"Cleared the air."
She looked down.
"And you're in my territory, madam."
"Madam?"
Thunder rolled in the distance. The permanent Lancre storm, after a trip through the foothills, had drifted back towards the mountain for a one-night stand. The last rays of sunset shone livid through the clouds, and fat drops of water began to thud on the witch's pointed hats.
"I really don't have time for all this," snapped Granny, trembling. "I have far more important things to do."
"And me," said Nanny. "Good night to you."
"And you."
They turned their backs on one another and strode away into the downpour. The midnight rain drummed on McGrath's curtained windows as she thumbed her way purposefully through Goody Wimper's books of what, for want of any better word, could be called natural magic. The old woman had been a great collector of such things, and most unusually had written them down. Witches didn't normally have much use for literacy, but book after book was filled with tiny, meticulous handwriting, detailing the results of patient experiments in applied magic. Goody Wimper had, in fact, been a research witch. "Someone has to do it. It's all very well calling for Eye of Newt, but do you mean common, spotted, or great-crested? Which eye, anyway? Will tabby ochre do just as well? If we substitute egg white, will the spell A work, B fail, or C melt the bottom out of the cauldron?" Goody Wemper's curiosity about such things was huge and insatiable. Nearly insatiable. It was probably satiated in her last flight to test whether a broomstick could survive having its bristles pulled out one by one in mid-air. according to the small black raven she had trained as a flight recorder, the answer was almost certainly no. McGrath was looking up love spells. Every time she shut her eyes, she saw a red and yellow figure on the darkness inside. Something had to be done about it. She shut the book with a snap and looked at her notes. First, she had to find out his name. The old peel-the-apple trick should do that. You just peeled an apple, getting one length of the peel, and threw the peel behind you. It had landed in the shape of his name. Millions of girls had tried it, and had inevitably been disappointed. Unless the loved one was called Skuts. That was because they hadn't used an unripe sunset wonder picked 3 minutes before noon on the first frosty day in the autumn and peeled left-handedly using a silver knife with a blade less than half an inch wide. Goody had done a lot of experimenting and was quite explicit on the subject. McGrath always kept a few by for emergencies, and this was probably one. She took a deep breath and threw the peel over her shoulder. She turned slowly. "I'm a witch," she told herself. "This is just another spell. There's nothing to be frightened of. Get a grip of yourself, girl. Woman." She looked down and bit the back of her hand out of nervousness and embarrassment. "Who'd have thought it?" she said aloud. It had worked. She turned back to her notes, her heart fluttering. What was next? Ah, yes. Gathering fern seed in a silk handkerchief at dawn. Goody Wimper's tiny handwriting went on for 2 pages of detailed botanical instructions, which, if carefully followed, resulted in the kind of love potion that had to be kept in a tightly stoppered jar at the bottom of a bucket of iced water. McGrath pulled open her back door. The thunder had passed, but now the first grey light of the new day was drowned in a steady drizzle. But it still qualified as dawn, and McGrath was determined. Brambles tugging at her dress, her hair plastered against her head by the rain, she set out into the dripping forest. The trees shook, even without a breeze. Nanny Ogg was also out early. She hadn't been able to get any sleep anyway, and besides, she was worried about Grebo. Grebo was one of her few blind spots. While intellectually she would concede that he was indeed a fat, cunning, evil-smelling, multiple rapist, she nevertheless instinctively pictured him as the small, fluffy kitten he had been decades before. The fact that he had once chased a female wolf up a tree and seriously surprised a she-bear who had been innocently digging for roots didn't stop her worrying that something bad might happen to him. It was generally considered by everyone else in the kingdom that the only thing that might slow Grebo down was a direct meteorite strike. Now she was using a bit of elementary magic to follow his trail, although anyone with a sense of smell could have managed it. It had led her through the damp streets to the open gates of the castle. She gave the guards a nod as she went through. It didn't occur to either of them to stop her because witches, like beekeepers and big gorillas, went where they liked. In any case, an elderly lady banging a bowl with a spoon was probably not the spearhead of an invasion force. Life as a castle guard in Loncra was extremely boring. One of them, leaning on his spear as Nanny went past, wished there could be some excitement in his job. He will shortly learn the error of his ways. The other guard pulled himself together and saluted.
"Mornin', mum."
"Mornin', our Sean," said Nanny,
and sat off across the inner courtyard. Like all witches, Nanny Ogg had an aversion to front doors. She went round the back and entered the keep via the kitchens. A couple of maids curtsied to her. So did the head housekeeper, whom Nanny Ogg vaguely recognised as a daughter-in-law, although she couldn't remember her name. And so it was, when Lord Felmet came out of his bedroom, he saw, coming along the passage towards him, a witch. There was no doubt about it. From the tip of her pointed hat to her boots, she was a witch, and she was coming for him. McGrath slid helplessly down a bank. She was soaked to the skin and covered in mud. Somehow, she thought bitterly, when you read these spells, you always think of it being a fine sunny morning in late spring. And she had forgotten to check what bloody kind of bloody fern it bloody was. A tree tipped a load of raindrops onto her. McGrath pushed her sodden hair out of her eyes and sat down heavily on a fallen log, from which grew great clusters of pale and embarrassing fungus. It had seemed such a lovely idea. She'd had great hopes of the coven. She was sure it wasn't right to be a witch alone. You could get funny ideas. She'd dreamed of wise discussions of natural energies while a huge moon hung in the sky, and then possibly they'd try a few of the old dances described in some of Goody Wimper's books. Not actually naked, or sky-clad, as it was rather delightfully called, because McGrath had no illusions about the shape of her own body, and the older witches seemed solid across the hems. And anyway, that wasn't absolutely necessary. The book said that the old-time witches had sometimes danced in their shifts. McGrath had wondered about how you danced in shifts. Perhaps there wasn't room for them all to dance at once, she thought. What she hadn't expected was a couple of crotchety old women who were barely civil at the best of times and simply didn't enter into the spirit of things. Oh, they'd been kind to the baby in their own way, but she couldn't help feeling that if a witch was kind to someone, it was entirely for deeply selfish reasons. And when they did magic, they made it look as ordinary as housekeeping. They didn't wear any occult jewellery. McGrath was a great believer in occult jewellery. It was all going wrong, and she was going home. She stood up, wrapped her damp dress around her, and set off through the misty woods. And heard running feet. Someone was coming through them at high speed, without caring who heard him, and over the top of the sound of breaking twigs was a curious dull jingling. McGrath sidled behind a dripping holly bush and peered cautiously through the leaves. It was Sean, the youngest of Nanny Ogg's sons, and the metal noise was caused by his suit of chain mail, which was several sizes too big for him. Lancre is a poor kingdom, and over the centuries the chain mail of the palace guards has had to be handed down from one generation to another, often at the end of a long stick. This one made him look like a bulletproof bloodhound. She stepped out in front of him. "Is that you, Miss McGrath?" said Sean, raising the flap of the mail that covered his eyes. "It's Mam." "What's happened to her?"
"He's locked her up. Said she was coming to poison him, and I can't get down to the dungeons to see, because there's all new guards. They say she's been put in chains."
Sean frowned.
"And that means something horrible's going to happen. You know what she's like when she loses her temper. We'll never hear the last of it, miss."
"Where were you going?" demanded McGrath.
"To fetch our Jason and our Wayne and our Darren and our..."
"Wait a moment.
Oh, Miss McGrath, suppose they try to torture her. You know what a tongue she's got on her when she gets angry."
"I'm thinking," said McGrath.
"He's put his own bodyguards on the gates and everything."
"Look, just shut up a minute, will you, Sean?
When our Jason finds out, he's going to give the Duke a real seeing to, miss. He said it's about time someone did."
Nanny Ogg's Jason was a young man with the build, and McGrath had always thought, the brains of a herd of oxen. Thick-skinned though he was, she doubted whether he could survive a hail of arrows. "Don't tell him yet," she said thoughtfully. "There could be another way."
"I'll go and find Granny Weatherwax, shall I, miss?" said Sean, hopping from one leg to another. "She'll know what to do. She's a witch."
McGrath stood absolutely still. She had thought she was angry before, but now she was furious. She was wet and cold and hungry, and this person. Once upon a time, she heard herself thinking, she would have burst into tears at this point.
"Oops," said Sean. "I didn't mean... whoops.
He backed away. "If you happen to see Granny Weatherwax," said McGrath, slowly, in tones that should have etched her words into glass, "you can tell her that I will sort it all out. Now go away before I turn you into a frog. You look like one anyway." She turned, hitched up her skirts, and ran like hell towards her cottage.